As if all that's not enough, we also welcome into the program to set the bar high for the rest of our guests this afternoon from Defector and the Distraction Podcast, David Roth with us. Hello there, Mr. Roth.
Hey, man, how are you doing?
Thank you
for receiving episode 2640 for me.
That's the one I've circled for the longest time. I said David needs to be part of this one because it's a cool round number.
Yeah, it is. It's solid. It's got the kind of you'd kind of find out that's the new Jewish New Year in Rosh Hashanah, and you're like, oh, neat. That's a large number. That'd be my experience of it. Maybe probably not yours.
I'm trying to think. Is it more shows than Cal Ripken consecutive games? I have to search the memory banks for that one. I don't know.
I think that when you decide to hang them up, you will be bumping right up against that number. But I'm not sure exactly where we are in that journey yet. Only you really truly know the answer to that.
Unlike Cal Ripken, I will be very ineffective at the end, I suspect.
Be different. Your range might have gone down a little bit, but whatever. He was still effective at third.
Right.
You wind up just kind of doing the weather on your own show. I think it still counts.
I'm just trying to accumulate numbers at that point, but really, aren't we all?
Yeah. Whatever. Padding your stats is not like the victimless crime.
So I don't usually make requests, I try to be accommodating to guests, but you've been doing this with us for a long time now, and I'm a little bit jealous. I know, look, the Distraction is your baby, and it's great, and we love it, but is there a chance we could get a little Al Pacino voice here on our show?
Oh, God. Yeah, there was more of that. We had, on the podcast this week, we had Vince Mancini, who is the film critic for Up Rocks and a very good podcaster in his own right. And I don't remember exactly how we started talking about the movie Devil's Advocate. It's probably my fault because most conversations that start in the United States in the year 2022 are me trying to get people to talk to me about the Devil's Advocate. Have you seen that movie? Do you know it?
Oh, I know that movie, and I love that movie because it's definitely right up there in my hall of movies that are so bad they're good.
Yes. I mean, I can't even tell if it's bad. Like, I think it's just bizarre and trashy. Al Pacino at his absolute shouting guy peak, playing the devil, but dressing like a guy who manages a jazz club, like which is how he thinks. It's also just how he dresses, but really good stuff. So him with a scarf on being like, who could, just like eschatology, like booming out stuff about angels and demons, while Keanu Reeves kind of sits there looking like he just woke up from like a long nap. Really fantastic stuff. Cannot recommend it highly enough.
And some gratuitous nudity as well.
There's some. But that's the type of movie that we're talking about here. There's, some gratuitous nudity, some CGI that, like, honestly, if you had told me that it was, like, done in 1974 and just banked in a vault until such time as Taylor Hackford gained access to it, I would believe it. Just a lot of really great stuff happening in there.
Oh, man. I feel better now just talking about Devil's Advocate for a minute. It lifts the spirit.
Yeah, it is, which is weird, because again, to reiterate, what we're talking about is a movie where the devil torments and tempts, and I guess you'd have to say ultimately defeats Keanu Reeves.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's
but
going to
I
happen.
Can't lift your, I mean, I guess that does sort of let you know where the bar was starting out, on even on a Friday show. But it's like, yeah, you remember when the devil who was dressed like kind of a beat poet, remember when he won? That was fun. We had a good time with that.
Well, now, speaking of Keanu, while we're on that subject, are you surprised that, I don't know if it's his transformation or not, but he's become, I guess, the conscience of a nation here. He's emerged as something greater than I imagined he would have been back in the Bill and Ted days.
Yeah, he seems like one of those people. I really hope that he can sort of keep this status, because there are these people that get anointed as, like our sainted Americans. Dolly Parton is another one, and they generally do tend to rule, like they're good people, and yet I worry about all of that. The more exalted they become, the more vulnerable they become. And so whatever, if it turns out that Keanu, like we find out he's just like a big Cowboys fan or something, and then everybody has to recalibrate their opinion of him, it would be really depressing to me. He seems like a chill guy. Like anytime you see a famous person that's actually normal and not secretly just like waiting to burst forth as circa now Aaron Rodgers or whatever, then like you got to give him credit for that.
I like that you mentioned the Dallas Cowboys, because I wanted to bring up my favorite NFL coach, Mike McCarthy.
Oh, he's great. just doing fantastic, doing some of his best work in what is technically, I guess, his late career. But he's still coming up with new ways to make people mad, which, you know, after all the work that he did in Green Bay, you might have thought he was out of tricks. Not so.
I had somebody describe him recently as a guy playing the role of an NFL coach and doing the things that he thinks you're supposed to do if you're in that role and if you came from Western Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. I like that he kind of tweaked his look a little bit when he went to Dallas. Like, the Green Bay thing was just him. I mean, there's only so many ways that you can look on the sideline if you're coaching a football game at Lambeau Field. Like, you're just going to, like, you put on every article of clothing that you've been issued by the team because it's 6 degrees, and then you wear all of them at the same time. So it's like the vibe is really what you're going off of. In Dallas, where you're in climate-controlled comfort, give or take the glare coming through one end of the stadium, you can really begin to play with your look a little bit. And this was McCarthy kind of slicked it up a little bit this year. Looked like he might have been getting, I don't know, some... He put more thought into the arrangement of his eyebrows and hair, and it came out just as great as you'd expect. Like, he's a strange fellow. Like, there are those coaches that seem kind of like people that couldn't do any other job. And right. He's sort of got a little bit of that, where it's just one of those people where his relationship with subordinates and the rest of the world and the general public sort of, like, specifically vis-a-vis him doing his job, like, that's not sustainable if he has a job in construction or as an attorney or whatever. Like, you really have to be the football coach of the Dallas Cowboys to get away with being the way he is.
I also like that it seemed that he never imagined anybody would ask him after the game about running the ball up the middle with time running out.
Yeah, I mean, and that is the McCarthy difference right there, because everybody that was watching that, especially the part, I mean, I'm not a big at-home shouter in games that don't have teams that I care about involved in them. But that play where Prescott runs and then hands the ball to his own center instead of the official, to me, I was just like, what game? There's officials there. This is an organized game. Like, that is maybe how you would do it if you were playing, like, a game with your buddies on a snow day.
Right, and your mom says the streetlights are on. You got one more play.
Right. Like, this is just... Then, you know, McCarthy being like, we practice it all the time. It's obviously the right play. Like, you know, you practice it all the time. Like, have somebody on your scout team pretend to be the official then, because you're practicing it wrong, it seems like.
And isn't it the Jerry Jonesiest thing in the world that he built this gazillion-dollar monument to himself and never took into account, boy, the sun is going to come through that glass. And there may be times in the game when the players can't actually see a damn thing.
So baffling. And the visuals from it, I mean, I guess I was aware of it because, like, I probably, you know, like, in the way that people are supposed to, like, swallow a couple of spiders every year without knowing it, like, I've probably watched a dozen games from Cowboy Stadium without ever choosing to do it. It's just, like, you know, what happens.
And that is the equivalent of swallowing spiders by accident, you're right.
It is kind of a similar vibe, in the same way that it's, like, obviously not advisable, but also apparently can't be helped. In this case, though, like, I don't think I had ever noticed until I started seeing the still images of, you know, like, what the 49ers were seeing on, like, kickoff return attempts and stuff. And it's baffling. Like, it just, I didn't think that you could spend $1 billion on a stadium and have it be oriented wrong relative to the sun, which comes up and goes down in the same place every single day. It reminds me of, I saw a minor league game at the stadium in, what's it? Oh, it's Western Mass. Whatever it was. The stadium doesn't exist anymore, but it was such a bad sun field.
Yeah, it was it Lowell?
They had sun delays.
The Lowell Spinners?
No, it wasn't Lowell. This was older. This was,
oh, okay.
It was a Red Sox team. This is embarrassing that I'm forgetting the name of it now. But it was, I want to say it's like maybe Springfield. Whatever it was, the stadium was set up so wrong that they would, every game around like the fifth inning, they would just have to stop for 30 minutes and they'd play music because nobody could see.
I had that experience. I was broadcasting a Maine game years ago down at William and Mary, beautiful place. But the stadium was old at the time. And the longtime William and Mary radio guy came into the booth and said, I used to do the games from this booth myself, but we moved to the other side a few years ago. You will find out why, I would say late second quarter. And sure enough, blinded by the sun for, I would say, a solid hour of that game.
Brutal. I mean, it is, again, though, you know, this is, sometimes you wish that there were metaphors for everything, and then sometimes you just get handed an actual visual metaphor of the experience of, you know, poor planning delivering poor results.
David Roth with us here on Downtown. Does it seem to you, as it does me, that the NFL might be the only thing that's bigger than COVID?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely does sort of seem like they've very quietly stopped having cases or stopped doing tests in the last couple of weeks. Like, this is, I was joking on the podcast this week, the CDC has updated its guidelines for when tight ends can return to work, but it definitely has this feeling of, like, it just sort of disappeared. And, you know, that is a very, I mean, whatever, again, one of those things that kind of maybe starts in the NFL and then spreads metastatically throughout the rest of our society, but the NFL is naturally where that would start.
How are things progressing in your efforts to build a national championship program at the University of Austin?
Well, there have been some setbacks,
no.
Mostly because I think everybody assumed the school wasn't really happening. But there was a bit earlier this week where they're still talking about it. The University of Austin, for those who are spending their time online in healthier corners than you or I, is it was like a sort of free thinker. It's basically like a Sarah Jones, the writer, called it a Bible school for libertarians, but it was basically just a place where people could go and learn about competition and the free market from people who get yelled at on Twitter all day long. It seemed pretty fake, especially because you don't usually announce that you're starting a university by asking people for donations online. But they're still doing it, and a lot of these people are still attached. The Harvard historian Niall Ferguson was saying that he hopes his sons will go there, which I don't think that's going to happen at all.
Oh, I have an update. Our friend Bruce Pratt has sent me a message. Wacona Park in Pittsfield, Mass.
That's exactly right. I was concentrating on what you were saying, but I was trying to remember Pittsfield, and I couldn't really do it. That is exactly the park. I think the last time I'd seen it, it had flooded very badly or something. Okay. I don't think there's an affiliated team there anymore. But, yeah, it was it's actually a very pleasant place to watch a baseball game when the game was happening. Otherwise, you're just kind of squinting a lot and waiting for the sun to go down.
While we're talking baseball, we know about your long avowed appreciation of some guys from the baseball world. And I got to thinking about this the other day, and I thought I'd ask you on the spot. I don't want to throw you a big curveball here, but do you have a favorite utility player of all time?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, a lot of them. This was, I don't know what this says about my sort of understanding of myself and my abilities as a baseball player, but even when, you know, the major league dream was still alive and I was playing in eighth and ninth grade, those were the guys that I was sort of aspiring to be. Like, I think that there was a part of me that had, you know, I realized that the ship had sailed and, like, it wasn't going to be Mike Schmidt. It was going to be Rick Shue for me.
Well, yeah, because they were 5'9", 165. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, at the time I was still pretty little. I'm like a normal sized adult now. I just was not, at that time I was too skinny and, probably my bat was slow. A guy I loved who played for the Mets and a bunch of other teams as a utility player was Desi Relaford. It's a terrific name. Like, I feel like Desi Relaford as a baseball player works in the 1920s as well as it works in the 1990s. And he had like a couple of good games for the Mets. He pitched once, which is something that I always enjoy when utility players do. All the Omar Minaya Mets teams would always have one kind of like late career utility guy. Sometimes it would be someone like Damian Easley who had like made an all-star team in their career. But oftentimes it was just kind of, you know, Alex Cora and Desi Relaford and Marlon Anderson. And I loved those guys, mostly in the way that, you know, football fans love backup quarterbacks, because they were forever coming in to like relieve Luis Castillo. And I'd be like, oh, Mike Evans, terrific. I have to watch Luis Castillo for the next two innings of this game.
I always loved Tony Phillips, but he's almost too good because he was so skilled at it. But I go back because I'm that much older. I always loved guys like Cesar Tovar, who played everywhere. And then mostly from his brief turn with the Red Sox, when I believe he pulled off an unassisted triple play. And when he had a perm, he may have been objectively the least attractive man in professional sports, Jack Brohammer.
Gosh, It was incredible how permissive perm rules used to be in Major League Baseball.
Oh yes,
it was, because as a young fan, I remember like seeing Pascual Perez, probably one of the wettest guys.
From the standpoint
of dampness, but that was a Jerry Curl.
Right. Like,
there were also a ton of Doug Graybeck or whatever, just kind of like country seeming white dudes that would take the time on an off day, get the perm juice that smelled like a Starbucks bathroom, put into their hair, and then show up the next day just lustrous and bouncy, Don Sutton style.
Oh God, yeah. All right, we have to touch at least a little bit on politics when you meet with us, but we're always often looking at the Republican side of things, and just to be fair, there's plenty of incompetence to go around in the political sphere here, and I think we're seeing an epic performance of late from Chuck Schumer and his colossal inability to rally the troops.
It's weird. I mean, I feel like in some ways Schumer is probably doing the best work of his career in terms of actively trying, and yet consider what that says about the rest of his career. I mean, that there's something about him. So this is like the thing that's always sort of confounded me about Schumer. Somebody, he's been by senator in New York for longer than anybody that I grew up with in New Jersey was ever my senator. And Schumer famously, used to say that he based all his decisions on a family called the Baileys. They live in Long Island. The dad's got this job and the mom's got this job. And it's not exactly like the dad works construction and the mom's a nurse or something like that. But it's, professions that are kind of weighted culturally in the direction of basically what he's talking about is Reagan Democrats. He's saying, I make every decision based on how it would impact the Baileys and how the Baileys would feel about it. And the thing that is confusing about that, if you live in contemporary America as opposed to Charles Schumer's 1994 fantasy land, is that the Baileys voted for Trump twice.
Yeah.
They don't really exist. They're a notional family that he made up for rhetorical purposes. But those people are gone. Like, that ship has kind of sailed. And in terms of what you do to get them back, I mean, this is the real sort of Democrat part of it that, it's not just Schumer that seems enthralled to this idea, is that somehow if you speak the right words in the right order, you can convince these people that you are normal and don't want to harm them, even though they're getting every day from their own partisan media nothing but testaments to how depraved and evil and predatory you are. Whereas I think the alternative would be you just do things for them, and maybe they notice it,
right,
and maybe they don't. But either way, like, at some point, if, and this is, the part that's been kind of confusing about this, is that, there was, it's now, all since gone by the boards when the new year turned, but there was a very generous and very effective, we now know, aid package passed by the Senate, signed by Joe Biden Trump did one too, but Biden's was better. And that really didn't move the needle hardly at all. I mean, I think that people didn't notice that they were getting all of this aid necessarily, in part because Democrats don't want to talk about it. They're convinced that when you say stuff like that, it puts off the Baileys. They start thinking about all the other people that are getting it.
Right.
And what if they don't deserve it? What if they're minorities? And all of that is, to me, like, it's just beyond being, I think, like, intellectually and politically backwards. It also just strikes me as the wrong vibe. Like, if you're coming off as apologetic or not trusting your stuff or whatever, like, you will lose. I just think that isn't what people want to vote for.
Yeah, and Schumer, too, for as long as he's been doing this, every time he gives a public speech of some kind, it sounds to me like he had just won the High School Daughters of the American Revolution essay contest.
Yeah. I mean, so many of these guys just have, I mean, I guess it just feels like sort of small-timey to me. He is not young. I mean, I think a lot of the people that are in positions of leadership in the Democratic Party are 20 years older than him. And in that case, including Biden, but I think including Nancy Pelosi and stuff. And there are times when you hear those sorts of people talk where it just seems clear that they are living in a version of America that other people are not inhabiting, either because they're older and richer and have been in power longer. I mean, that probably has a lot of it. But also, I just think if you are in office and in a position of power for too long, you really can lose yourself in a way that I don't know how you can lose your... I mean, if you were Aaron Rodgers or if you were a famous person, you could be as disconnected. But otherwise, I just don't know how you wind up there. And so you wind up with these sort of not just policies that don't necessarily like either advocate for themselves or get forcefully advocated for by the people behind them, but policies that sort of seem impossible to penetrate. Like the idea of a lot of this stuff in Build Back Better being built around this 10-year timeline, like you and I may know why they did that, which is like to get it through reconciliation and to, you know, sort of do all of the Senate trickery you need to do. But so much of the time, the policies that they wind up passing are so confusing and so sort of piecemeal and means-tested and parted out that it's almost impossible to tell how they're helping you or if they're helping you at all.
On the plus side, he wasn't sending text messages to Rudy Giuliani explaining that he had a cousin named Vinny who would reliably play a fake elector if needed.
It is really, like, this is the other thing that's weird about it. And I've gotten, you know, people have gotten on me for this in the past. And I think not unjustifiably so. I am critical of the Democrats because I'm frustrated by the fact that they are not doing seemingly anything to improve daily life in these United States. And yet, the other side are just absolutely out there playing weird cloak and dagger grab ass games on like speakerphone in front of the U.S. attorney. Like, and so this is another reason to be frustrated by it, is that, like, you know, if and when they lose power, the people that will take power are, you know, whatever, your Giuliani-ocrats on the other side of it.
Suddenly, Mike McCarthy seems somewhat more functional than I thought.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, at least you can kind of tell what he's going for with his look. Like, I don't know why Chuck Schumer doesn't get some glasses that fit.
Let that beard grow out a little bit. He'd be just fine. Thank you. David Roth, defector.com, The Distraction. Always a pleasure, my friend. Thanks for being with us today.
Man, thanks for having me. I'm glad to talk to you every time we do it.
All right, we'll do it again soon. Thanks, David.
Right on. Take care, man.